This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. When tax time rolls around each spring, Steve Martin must need an extra line or two to describe his occupation. Magician, banjo player, actor, comedian, playwright, screenwriter, and novelist. His first, called Shop Girl, is already on its way to the movies. His latest bestseller, The Pleasure of My Company, has just come out in paperback. Clearly, the next logical step in this long career is reality television. Later in the program, we'll talk with NPR sports correspondent Tom Goldman about the latest twist in the widening steroid scandal. But first, Steve Martin joins us from NPR West. If you have a question about his movies, TV show, or his books, give us a call. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is TOTN at NPR.org. Steve Martin, welcome back to Talk of the Nation.
Hi, how are you?
Very well, thanks.
And actually, that drug scandal really applies to me. I think writers should be tested for steroid use.
We've always wondered. Everybody's always wanted to know, is Steve Martin taking steroids?
Absolutely. But I think a lot of writers are taking vitamins, and I think that's wrong. They're trying to improve their mind. I think that's cheating.
So what do you put on your tax forms? As little as possible, but other than that.
The truth is I don't look at it. I just sign it. So it probably says actor. That became the easiest one-word description. Sometimes I have to fill out what I do for a living, you know, when you're crossing borders, especially when you're doing covert work for the government. And so I just write actor.
And the covert work for the government, that's the arrow through the head. That's not a problem with that.
Well, it breaks down.
I see. Oh,
it breaks down.
So it's new technology. It's coming along all the time.
Yes. And also, I noticed earlier you were talking about the Chinese political situation, and I coincidentally had my entire dossier on Chinese political politics here with me, and I'll send it off to you.
Oh, the Sino-Soviet split, that passage has got to be fascinating.
It's one of my areas of expertise.
Mm-hmm. Well, tell us about another area of expertise. I wasn't joking about reality TV. You're working on a show called The Scholar?
Yes. I have a television company, a partner with Joan Stein, and it's... You know, we develop shows, and this idea was actually brought to us. It wasn't my own idea. It's not my, again, whereas Chinese politics is my area of expertise, actually the collegiate world right now is not.
Mm-hmm.
So actually other people are developing it, and I'm contributing to it, along with Joan Stein. In fact, I have a meeting right after this about it. And I hate to say use these words because everybody says they're excited about things, but... it will give away a full 4-year scholarship to a deserving youth.
And just off the top of your head, I mean, this sounds like a reality TV show for PBS.
It kind of does, but it's for ABC, and they're fully behind it. And, you know, the toughest part is to, because reality television is based on humiliation, not to humiliate our contestants.
So there's no questions about Kierkegaard.
There may be. But, you know, we need that kind of Jeopardy challenges where you're just so impressed with the brilliance of these people as they win money.
As long as you don't get Ken Jennings on the show.
We don't want him.
No, you don't want him. He just keeps winning and winning and winning. It's, boy, it's hard. As we mentioned, your latest novella is out in paperback. Novella, both of your novels, I call them, but they're both, in terms of strictly length, novellas. Is there something about the length? You just couldn't finish it?
Yeah, I just stop. That was a joke.
I figured it was a joke.
No, actually, I thought about this. I've thought about this before, and I was especially thinking about it last night because I was talking to a friend, and I was mentioning I was going to do the interview, and they said, what do you do the interview on? And I said, well, really, a paperback. And, you know, I've done interviews on the hardback a year ago, and now I'm doing interviews on the paperback. And the first thing was, well, what's the difference? And there actually is a difference. And the difference is this, that in the hardback, there were printing errors that, to me, hurt the integrity of the book. And they would be rare had they not been 200,000 copies published.
I see.
They'd be collectible, I should say.
Yeah, like the upside-down airplane or something stamp.
Pardon me?
Like the stamp that has the upside-down airplane, yeah.
Exactly. And but it's, in this case, it actually, to me, affected the intensity and outcome, emotional content of the book. So it was published with errata sheets, and the errata sheets were, you know, hustled out to the bookstores, and of course no one ever got them. Mm-hmm.
Can you give us an example of something that changed?
Yes. In the book, the character is, for lack of better words, and I don't think this quite applies, obsessive compulsive mm-hmm. To a humorous degree, I should say. And one of the things he does to relax, and when he gets agitated, for example, he can't cross the street at the curb. He finds that illogical, that there's a barrier there, so he can only cross the street where two opposing driveways meet, because there it makes complete sense to him that there's an opening in the street, for example. And one of the things, when he gets frustrated, in order to relax, is he makes magic squares, and he goes to the art supply store and buys big sheets of cardboard, and a magic square is a square filled with numbers that add the same in any direction you add them. And he intuits them. He can close his eyes, picture the square, and the numbers come to him, and he fills out the magic square. And he finds it relaxing because it's so occupying. And as his in the opening of the book, his life is very, very closed off, very isolated. But as people start to come into his life, he creates magic squares with people in them. And he's always trying to find the center, who the center of the square is. And it's always empty. And in the public, and so these change as different people come to life. He puts different names into the squares. And when these were printed, for some reason, a couple of them were substituted with dummy copy, which bore no relationship to the book at all. And or was out of sequence, and I found it quite disturbing.
Hmm.
So the errors have been corrected in this paperback version.
You're also...
Oh, but that didn't even answer your question.
Yeah, no,
that's what I'm trying to fill 50 minutes here.
Well, that's my job. Your job is just to answer the questions here.
I just go yes and no. That's great.
Okay.
The reason the books are short is that, one, being an entertainer, I always know that shorter is better. And but that's not the main reason. The main reason is that I feel the books are dense. And I think in the sense that the language is it's not just simple storytelling, which I admire and envy. There's a lot of thought. There's a lot of exploration of mind. There's a lot of language. And there's a lot of, I would call, sometimes more lyrical writing. And I don't think you can go on too long with that kind of writing.
Here's an email question from James in Cleveland, Ohio. As a writer, I'm always curious how other writers do it. Do you have any rituals? Do you keep journals, pen and paper, before you go on the computer?
I work only when I'm inspired. I find that that daily grind is not the way I do it. I deeply believe in a subconscious process, that when you're not working, or when you're, we'll use the word blocked, although I don't really run up against that, because I don't try to write if I'm not in the mood. I believe that the subconscious mind is forming ideas, and then suddenly they're ready, and you sit down, and that's when they start to come. So I don't... I don't punish myself.
You don't stare at that blank screen.
No. I was gonna nothing. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's interesting. Let's get some callers.
God, it better be.
Let's hope so.
Tough interview. Yeah.
800-989-8255. 800-989-TALK. Our email address is TOTN@npr.org. And we'll talk first with Steve. Steve on the line from Berkeley, California.
Oh, it's great. Same name.
Hey, thanks for taking my call.
My pleasure.
Steve, a pleasure to speak with you, sir. Just wanted to say, Let's Get Small, my favorite comedy album of all time, bro. Wondering when you might be getting back out on the road and getting back into that vein.
Oh, yes. I will be out on the road never. So you can put that on your calendar. Well, thank you. Let's Get Small was my first comedy record, and it was recorded in such a homemade process. I had a manager named Bill McEwen who followed me around, and actually on the record, it was all nightclubs. And then the next album was A Wild and Crazy Guy, which was all concert arenas. And so the difference is, you know, that sort of nightclub sound with the sporadic laughter, and you can actually hear my manager, you know, sometimes the only one laughing. But we used to drive around to these, what they were then, folk music clubs, coffee houses, and record me.
And you say never because it was such a wonderful experience?
Yes. You know what? I'll tell you, it's a complete experience, and it's a younger person's experience. You know, a different town every night is not the way I live now. It's just not.
And
also, you have to be a stand-up comedian, to be sharp, you have to do it all the time. That's what I found. When I was doing my stand-up act, and I'd be, for example, going on The Tonight Show, I always tried to work the night before. If I took even a day off, I felt a weird kind of timing slip. It's like a maybe a dancer or... Yeah, it was that kind of feeling that I just really needed to stay sharp.
Okay. Steve, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. Let's go to Laura. Laura's calling from Oakland, California.
Hello.
Geographic diversity here. Go ahead, Laura.
Yeah.
Hi, Steve Martin. I just wanted to say that my three-year-old son enjoys your balloon skit from the old Muppet Show.
Uh-huh, good.
And,
good. That's about the right age, I would say.
Well, I do, too, but I guess I shouldn't admit that.
Mm-hmm. You should give him my book.
He'll probably need 4 or 5 copies.
He's been tossing around this copy of Dostoevsky, so maybe he'd be ready for your book.
Okay. Well, he should get through that book first, I think, before he attempts mine.
Okay. I have a BA in philosophy. Mm-hmm. I understand that you have a PhD.
You know, this is one of those you know, things that gets out there that it's absolutely not true. I do have a PhD,
oh.
An honorary PhD from the school I went to, Long Beach State. But I studied philosophy in college. I went to college for 4 years. I changed my major in the last year from philosophy to theater, and I was taking a television writing course, and I... through a weird sequence of events, got a job writing for the Smothers Brothers Comedy Hour, and I quit school. So I don't even have a BA.
Oh, so we should then just drop out and replace philosophy with TV.
I guess that's that's the message I'm trying to deliver to your son.
Okay.
So
okay, well, that totally changes my entire life.
There's also another rumor that I'm a Mormon, and that... rumor was created, which I'm not, but that rumor was created because I was in a movie and I wore like a T-shirt underneath that had a scooped neck. It was just kind of a T-shirt I wore at the time, and it looks like garments, which is something that Mormons wear, I think, during a period of their induction into the church. So that rumor is a false one, too.
Laura, thanks very much for the call, and take care of that little philosopher we hear in the background.
Thank you.
And Steve Martin, your answer...
Why am I here? I'm humiliating myself. I'm letting all these like great rumors about me die out here. I like the idea of a PhD in philosophy. I wish.
But now we get it. The scholar, you're going to be a contestant.
Exactly. I'm trying to get that BA.
We're talking with Steve Martin. When we come back from a break, we'll take more of your calls. Our number, if you'd like to join us, is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also send us email. The address is TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with actor, writer, banjo player, and novelist Steve Martin. His latest novel, The Pleasure of My Company, is just out in paperback. You're invited to join us. 800-989-8255. If you have a question for Steve Martin, you can also email us, TOTN@npr.org. And you mentioned your days of performing on the road in the last segment. Here's some tape of you performing at the boarding house in San Francisco in the late 1970s. In this bit, you're having some trouble with getting the light crew to fulfill your request for a blue spotlight.
All right.
You know, I'm really up to here with this.
It's just a matter that, you know, I am on stage, and it's my house out here, you know what I mean? And I come out, and I'm giving, and I'm giving, and I'm giving, and I keep giving, and I give some more, and I make a simple request. I say, hey, could I possibly have a blue spot? But I guess the lighting crew feels they know a little bit more about show business than I do. Although I've been in the business a few years, and I think I know what works best. I'm sorry, but I am angry. I come out here, and I can't get a little cooperation from the backstage crew. Excuse me.
Steve Martin at NPR West. Except for moments, occasions like this, do you ever go back and listen to any of that stuff?
Never. Never. I was listening to satellite radio in my car, and there's a comedy channel. And somebody came on, and I thought to myself, this guy is doing me. I can't believe he's got the same exact speech pattern. And then I listened to it. Oh, must have been listening to. Then I realized it was me. I didn't remember the routine or the sound of my own voice. By the way, who played that banjo? Was that broadcast, that banjo song?
Well, member stations around the country may have given traffic and weather over that banjo.
Idiots. Anyway, that was a nice banjo playing.
Let's talk.
I'd really like to know what the traffic and weather is around the country.
Your satellite radio can tell you that probably as well. Okay. Michelle is with us now on the line from Syracuse, New York.
Yes, Neil, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And Steve, I heard that banjo music. It was wonderful.
Well, that's not
why
me
I'm
playing.
Calling.
What? Okay, but that wasn't me playing.
Music from you.
Say that again.
I want to hear more banjo music from you. When are you going to put out a CD or a DVD or whatever they call them now?
Oh, well, get your pen and write this down. Never.
Okay.
No, I love to play. I'm an amateur player. Sometimes, in fact, I recently won, this is the equivalent of my PhD. I won a Grammy for Best Country Instrumentalist last year or year before last. And the reason I won that is Earl Scruggs put out a record, a 75th anniversary record, and they asked different people to play on it, Foggy Mountain Breakdown. So I played on it, and we all got, when he won, we all got these Grammys, but they're marked Best Country Instrumentalist. So I guess I have to accept it that I am the best country instrumentalist.
Yes. Yes, you are. Mm-hmm. I love banjo, and with bluegrass, like, it's going crazy because all this other music that's out there, more and more people are incorporating the banjo into music, and it's like it's such a happy instrument. You can't be sad with it, like you say, and it's just wonderful. And I really wish you would continue to do that.
Well, I do play a lot. In fact, I'm having a little bluegrass party next week with this beautiful
great
banjo player named Pete Wernick.
Here.
Yeah, and but also the banjo is happy, but it's also can be very, very melancholy, which is a quality I love about the banjo.
Michelle, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you for taking my call again. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. You also did win a Grammar Award for Best Comedy Syntax. But
Thank you very much.
But, you mentioned earlier
I wish I could win a Grammar Award.
you wrote for the Smothers Brothers back in the 60s, I guess it was, or early 70s.
Late 60s and early 70s. Yeah, well, yeah.
At the time, now, that was the most political show on television. In fact, they got canceled a couple of times for being too political. And you've gone the rest of your career sort of determinedly apolitical. How come?
Well, a couple of reasons. One, I I like being a comedian, and I like if the public sees me that they're not making, you know, political connections to what I do, what I write, what I say. So I keep my politics to myself. Also, I think, you know, I'm not learned enough to debate politics, to present those ideas in a sophisticated way. And I think that's actually a problem, is that there's almost too much celebrity stuff out there of, you know, just endorsement of somebody just by standing there. And I don't feel I have actually, I mean, I have the right, but I don't have the right more than anyone else to purvey my political thoughts publicly. But I do write, I had a little, a friend who said, I'm going to try and write a speech for John Kerry. And so she sat down and I had lunch with her the next day. She said, I tried to write it. I couldn't do it. And because everything that came up was politically incorrect or was offensive to someone. Mm-hmm. So I gave it a try. I sat one night and tried to write a speech for John Kerry, which I did. And I kept it to myself. But it was a good exercise in writing down your own beliefs.
All right. Let's get another caller on the line. And Stephen joins us on the phone from Sarajevo.
Sarajevo.
Hi, Steve.
It's good to be talking with you. You've been one of my favorite entertainers over the years. I've been in Sarajevo for a couple of years now, and the folks here are interested in many aspects of American culture, especially movies and comedians and such, but no one has heard of you here, except for one group.
One who? One group?
Dentists have heard of you.
Yes, I've played a couple of dentists.
I'm sorry, Stephen, that last line we missed?
I say... They're the only ones, and I'm not kidding. I have actually asked around, and I have some of your records and things, and I play bits and pieces, and I get kind of a glassy-eyed stare.
Well, that's completely understandable. Two things. One is why dentists. I played two dentists. I played in Little Shop of Horrors, an insane dentist, and then I in a movie called Novocaine, I played not an insane dentist but a desperate dentist. And that may reach the dentist, which is the audience I'm targeting in Sarajevo. So actually, my publicity scheme there is working quite well.
There is one dentist in particular that actually has a picture of you. Little Shop of Horrors.
That's the grassroots. That's the beginning of the grassroots Steve Martin movie swelling in Sarajevo.
Interestingly, a friend of mine was in a movie with you, House Sitter, Woody Bruhn, who his film career was largely composed of playing clerks and dentists. He played a clerk in House Sitter. He said he always would say that, you know, that's acting. You know, when you can hold up the drill and point to the fish on the wall, boy, you'd better be good when you're playing a dentist.
Well, you do have to learn to use the tools. That's true. I went to visited a dentist in New York and stayed there and learned to use the tools. And you got to look like you can handle them. Okay. And now I actually do dentistry on the side.
On the side. Yeah. That's great. Stephen, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
So we're live in Sarajevo now?
We're live in Sarajevo, the reach of all kinds of...
You know, this is how I think, actually, Americans win the hearts and minds, is through our art and music and our, you know, freedom, in a sense, being broadcast around the world. So there you go. Yeah.
Andy's on the line from Binghamton, New York.
Anyone write that down.
Yeah, that's why I hesitated there.
Yeah.
Binghamton,
yeah.
New York. Andy.
Hello, Steve. I just wanted to steal a line from your movie and say you changed my life twice. I saw you 27 years ago perform at my college in upstate New York, and you truly were an entertainer, something that today comedians, I think, and others squander. You know, you played the banjo, as we heard. You told jokes. You juggled, a skill we don't see too often.
Yeah.
And after your performance, you actually came out of the auditorium and stood in the middle of the quad and did shtick for about 250 people. That was just riotous.
Yeah, I used to do that. That was a lot of fun. Once, early on, when the audience size was manageable, I was out of college, maybe yours, and we went outside and there was an empty swimming pool. And I had everyone get in the swimming pool, and then I swam over the tops of them.
Well, in this case, one of the campus police cars actually prowled up towards where this crowd was. I don't think they knew what was going on. And you looked over, and you had the crowd in your hand, and you said, if he gives us any trouble, we'll flip the car over. And if you had just given the word,
oh boy.
That officer would have been on his roof. But
those were different times. I would have been shot now.
Yes. I have to tell you about the second way that you changed my life, and that was I was dating online and put in my profile one of your quotes that there's someone out there for all of us, even if it takes a compass, a pickaxe, and night vision goggles to find them. And I had someone respond to that who I'm now living with.
Fantastic.
And my 8-year-old daughter is a big fan of your films, though I have to sort of explain your choice of names of dogs and
yeah.
What a little fireman is. But
yeah, okay.
This is the biggest thrill I've had speaking with you, and thank you very much for all of your work. You truly are a treasure.
Thank you very, very much.
Andy, does your wife know that that line wasn't yours?
Yes, she does, and she's not my wife.
Ah, okay. Well, I'm sorry to jump to the conclusion. Anyway, thanks for the phone call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Here's an email question from Mandy in Jacksonville, Florida. When you were growing up, did you know you were funny?
No, but I did know that I loved comedy, and I loved to laugh, and I loved to watch comedians. And I didn't, you don't really know you're funny because it's so hard to call yourself something that you are. For me, much, much later, and it really had the, professionally funny is one thing, and then sort of funny with your friends is another thing. And I really enjoy, being funny with friends, and I love to hang out with funny people. And I just grew up on comedy, and it just made me want to do it, to sort of relive the experience that someone sent to me. So, it's a complicated question because there's also, there's the funny years, and then there's the doer years,
Well, then there's also
in college and very serious and, confused, so you kind of...
Well, there's the philosophy student, and then there's the class clown.
Exactly.
Yeah. Both is, I guess, the answer. Well,
both.
Okay.
Well, okay.
we'll leave it there. What comedians, when you were a kid, that did you laugh at a lot?
Well, you have to understand that when I was a kid, it was television. I was born in 1945, and so let's say it's now 1953 or 4. Television was mostly showing older comedians. Films,
mm-hmm.
like Laurel and Hardy, Abbott and Costello.
Three Stooges, yeah.
I was not a fan so much of the Three Stooges, but I love Laurel and Hardy. And so those were the comedians I really, really grew up on. And then there was a big, big breakthrough with modern comedy with Lenny Bruce and Bob Newhart and Shelley Berman.
We're talking with Steve Martin. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Got another caller on the line. Lisa is with us from Concord, North Carolina.
Hello.
Hi.
Hello.
Hi. I'm in my car, so you just diminish.
Uh-oh.
But my question was, a lot of the callers have been calling and talking about how much we love Steve Martin that we, that we listen to and saw in the movies and stuff. And I was wondering, as far as your comedic personality, how much of that or how much of that did you get into your book?
Into my book? Well, the book, the first book, Shop Girl, is, I would not call it a funny book. It has funny sequences in it, but it is really it's quite a poignant book, I think. And the film that we have just finished of it, starring Claire Danes, is quite a poignant movie with humor. But Pleasure of My Company, I actually think of as a funny book. It is also quite poignant, I believe, but it is much has much more humor. But you have to be very careful in writing a comedy in a book because it's easy to just go beyond the truth of the character and maybe go for a joke. You have to. I really am careful about that. That all the humor in these two novels, anyway, has to be in a way believable. And I believe the humor in Pleasure of My Company is that kind of happy sad thing where the character gets himself in trouble and you just feel for him. So it's a delicate balance in novel writing. If I write a piece for The New Yorker, then anything goes. You know, you can just be silly or funny or make a point.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you one more question if I could?
Sure.
Why did you write the book Pleasure?
The Pleasure of My Company?
Yeah.
Why did I write it? Oh,
yes.
Well, actually, it's a lot of things grow from something else. And I had been writing some pieces for The New Yorker. And occasionally I would write about where the central figure was this, you know, slightly offbeat person. And a friend of mine, in fact, Joan Stein, who's my partner in this scholar enterprise, said to me, "I love it when you write about that guy." And I instantly knew what she was talking about. I thought, that guy, that is a rich character. Now, I'm not describing the character to you right now because it's too long a tale, but that's what this book is the development of that personality. And in a strange way, it relates to my stand-up comedy act because the character I did was closed off in a way and saw things in a different way and was arrogant, was the world's authority, and that doesn't quite relate to this book. But anyway, it's a long story.
Okay.
Yeah, I can't wait to read it.
Lisa, thanks very much for the call.
I enjoyed talking to you.
Okay, bye-bye. I think she enjoyed talking to you, not necessarily to me. Talk to me any day.
No, that she did not enjoy talking to you. It was strictly me.
When we come back from a short break, we're going to continue our conversation with Steve Martin. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Of course, we left a sometime singer off that list of occupations as well. I'm Neil Conan. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today we're talking with Steve Martin. The Pleasure of Pleasure of My Company is the name of his book, just out in paperback. He's with us from the studios of NPR West. And Steve, all of your biographical material says Steve Martin lives in Los Angeles and New York, which not easy when you think about it. But what do you consider home?
Los Angeles. That's where I essentially grew up, mostly. I did live in Aspen, Colorado. I lived in Santa Fe, New Mexico for a while. But really, L.A. is home.
And you grew up right outside of Disneyland.
I did. I grew up in Garden Grove, California. In fact, I just did a little film for Disneyland's 50th anniversary, and it's going to play inside the park, you know, and I'm sort of the host and working with Donald Duck, et cetera. But it was kind of, you know, I started working there when I was 10 at Disneyland, selling guidebooks. And I had various jobs ending up at the magic shop there doing magic tricks. And so it was kind of a full circle thing to have finally achieved hostdom at the Magic Kingdom, having started there as a kid.
And in a way, I mean, you're doing this show for ABC TV. You've done a lot of movies for Disney as well.
Yes. Bringing Down the House was for Disney, and so was Shop Girl.
Huh. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's get another caller on the line. Tom joins us
before
we run out of material. Tom is with us from Oklahoma City.
Hi there.
Hi.
I was backstage crew working on one of your shows, Picasso and Einstein, Lapin-Agile.
At the Lapin-Agile. Picasso at the Lapin-Agile is a play I wrote.
I loved it. It was great being backstage because I could hear your voice in the dialogue. It was just amazing. I was wondering what other shows that you might be having in the works, any other plays coming up?
Well, I did write some other plays, but I'm not writing one now because that's that inspiration issue. I remember once David Geffen called me, and he said, you know, it was like 1984, 95, and he said, you know what? You should go back on the road. You should go back to your comedy act. And I said, I don't have anything to say. And that's the way I feel about right now a play. I don't have anything to say. I like to think about it and wait till I have something to say, essentially, and figure out the best medium for it. So right now I've written the Pink Panther movie that is going to come out next summer, co-written, the Pink Panther movie, and I wrote the screenplay to Shop Girl, and I have adapted A.R. Gurney's play Sylvia into a screenplay, and that's kind of what I'm doing now, and writing little tidbits for The New Yorker occasionally. I have other plays. I have a play called Wasp, which is about a wasp family presented. It's a one act presented in a kind of funny and lyrical, strange way, which is a play I actually quite like.
You mentioned, obviously, you adapted Shop Girl for the movies. Mm-hmm. Very little dialogue in the book. Obviously, you had to write some for the film.
Right. And that was the book was written in kind of internally in terms inside people's heads. So I did have to write dialogue, but that was the challenge of it. And, you know, the movie is so not about dialogue. It's like the dialogue is it's almost the reverse of a normal movie I can't say that, but the visuals, and you kind of stay with the person and you stay with them, and the visuals are extremely important to the movie.
It's interesting, and you, as you mentioned, you wrote that book. It was a sort of a omniscient narrator in that first book. The second book, very first person.
Right.
Easier or harder?
Well, I wrote Shop Girl because it was my first attempt at a novel. I wrote it from an omniscient narrator because I thought it would be easier to begin with. Because, here I get the opportunity. I can say anything that's going on inside anyone's head. It might get me out of trouble. And I didn't know how long I could extend a book in the first person, how I could sustain it. But then once I had, on Pleasure of My Company, the character in mind fully, and it's, by the way, it sort of writes itself almost. I think one of the mistakes made in that I encounter in the television industry is they try to have you list characters' qualities. So you'll have a page and it'll say Joe, and it will say, you know, loves to have fun, likes blah, 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 blah. And this is so not the way to write characters. Characters are extremely subtle. And I guarantee you that any of that paragraph that describes that character will not end up in your screenplay, your book, or whatever, because five qualities of a character do not translate. All characters are subtle.
Tom, thanks very much for the call.
You bet.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
I go on too long?
No. You did great. And I know you need that reassurance from me.
Yes, I do. Thank you.
Well, which leads to my next question. You've succeeded at so many things. Do you still worry that, you know, the next thing out is going to be a turkey?
Well, absolutely. And that is, that just goes along with the territory. Everything, you know, the joy, I've learned that the joy in a movie is making it. The joy in a book is writing it. Because you cannot count on anything after that. If it's a success, that's another kind of happiness, a kind of practical happiness. If a book is a success, that's another kind of happiness too, but you really don't know what people are thinking.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
but there's kind of an awful period when you finish the book, you send it to the publishers, and then you wait 6 months, 8 months, a year.
Well, I'm in that now with Pink Panther and Shop Girl, and the kind of that state where it's gone away, and all that creative energy that goes into making something, the fun of it, the pain of it. I mean, everything I've ever done, with the exception of maybe one or two things, one of them was Roxanne, has had a negative period, a sour period, where it didn't quite work. It needs this, it needs that, it needs to be adjusted and fixed. And I keep reminding myself that that happens on everything. And I try to prevent myself from getting, not depressed, but, you know, down about it, or what am I doing? You know, quite challenging yourself, because you have to remember it happens all the time.
Are you afraid of getting found out that, you know, you've been faking it all these years?
No, I'm not. I don't have that. I had it for a while, but then sometimes you just give up on that and you realize, well, you know, I'm still here. I'm still here, and I'm, you know, I can get, there was something that, such a small little thing that kind of changed my outlook. When I did a, performers, creative people suffer from reviews, and I don't think critics actually know that. I remember I was talking to John Simon once, the critic, and he has a reputation for slaughtering people. And I had heard a story that an actress had gone up to him and thrown a glass of wine on him. And so I met him, and he was quite nice, and he was very smart, and I actually got along with him. But that didn't stop him from killing me, you know, 2 years later. But I asked him, I said, I heard a story that an actress threw a glass of red wine on you. And he said, yes, yes, she did. And I said, what did you say about her? And he said, nothing, nothing. I said, you had a big nose. So the story was, you know, you can't quite mature out of it. But eventually, I think I did. It was over my play, Picasso at the Lapin Argyle, and this play was a success, and I'm actually quite proud of it, and I think it's touching and moving. But that's me, you know. And it had been out about 2 years, and now I was going back to Chicago where it began, and a local, you know, paper, one of those, the Chicago version of the LA Weekly, gave it a, you know, horrible review, saying, you know, it's plays like this that keep, you know, real plays from being performed, which was the standard criticism of anything celebrity. But I know the criticism is not about the thing itself, but about the fact that you're famous, as that line sort of comes up, meaning, I guess it means that the critic is saying, well, my play is not being done. Exactly. But, and I just looked at this review. I don't even know how I ended up with it, but I thought, okay, so I wrote a play and he wrote a review. And that's the difference between us. And from then on, I thought, okay, I can go along and do my work and know that some will be interesting, some won't. Some will be fairly criticized, some will be unfairly criticized. And it's just part of the business. And, you know, I saw a great, am I going on too long? A documentary about David Hockney. And I talked to an art collector, a friend of mine, about 5 years ago, and I really like David Hockney, and I said, and he's a contemporary art collector, and I said, boy, do you have any Hockney? He goes, oh no, he's out of it, he's this, you know, blah, blah. And then I saw this documentary on him, and I realized Hockney doesn't care. Hockney's going on with his work, making beautiful things. He's in a way outside the contemporary mainstream art scene, although he's represented by important galleries in New York. But he was so enthused about his own work, it just didn't matter what people thought of him, what, you know, outside critics, people with their own specialized point of view, think of him. He's making beautiful, he was doing, at that point, stage design. Anyway, it made me really, really admire David Hockney.
Well, let's, I think we fooled him again, Steve.
We did?
Yeah, I think we did.
We're done with it?
I think we're done.
I'm just getting warmed up.
Oh, well.
Get my Chinese documents out.
There you go. Thanks very much for being with us.
Okay, thank you very much.
The Pleasure of My Company is Steve Martin's most recent book. It's out in paperback. Steve Martin was kind enough to join us from the studios of NPR West. And, well, here he is playing a little banjo. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.